Hi, this is Zoe.
And this is Justina.
And this is the Empowered Healing Podcast. All right, welcome back to the Empowered Healing Podcast.
Glad to be back.
Yay. Today, we're going to talk more about misdiagnosis, especially when it comes to neurodivergent people, autistic folks, ADHD. Years, and others who have spent years, sometimes decades, being told the wrong story about their brain. So if you've ever felt like you didn't fit the labels you were given, or something essential about you was missed, you are not alone. This episode is a conversation about what happens when your truth gets mislabeled and how people are reclaiming their identities and their care.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, because I do think it's, you know, a core part of who you are. And when that gets mislabeled or misidentified, there are obviously consequences to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I know we talked a little bit last episode of just starting to get into the misdiagnosis front. But in a nutshell, probably should start with the basics of what is a misdiagnosis. Okay. And I think the easiest way to put it is it's what happens when someone is given a mental health label that doesn't accurately reflect or portray the experience that they're living or their brain function.
Yeah.
In the neurodivergent community, this often looks like, you know, people with autism or ADHD, dyslexia, other forms of brain diversity tend to be overlooked, maybe confused with mental illness, or pathologized as something else altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like we are starting to understand that it is misdiagnosed pretty often.
The data is still somewhat limited, but, you know, we know it's more widespread than people think.
Right.
Looking at your statistics that you found, mm-hmm. There is one in 2021 that cited over 75% of participants who received an autism spectrum diagnosis. They received it about 8 years after their first mental health evaluation. That's a long time.
That's a really long time.
8 years of not knowing that one of these maybe fit you,
right?
That felt authentic to you.
Right.
And going back specifically, I know we've talked about women in depth mm-hmm. a lot, but there's a reason that... Yeah. It tends to happen a lot with women.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a highly masked autistic woman might be told she has social anxiety, OCD, BPD, mm-hmm. you know, all of the things before actually being told, hey, you know what? I think you're neurodivergent.
Right, right. And that is almost never in the initial considerations or conversations when people come in with some of these symptoms.
Yeah. Which is wild.
It is absolutely wild.
Because we even talked about last time how much of an overlap there are in symptomology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And we need to take more time to be intentional and suss out what those actually are, how it impacts somebody's functioning, how it shows up for them, if it shows up in certain situations. If it doesn't show up in other situations, like, hey, does this show up with strangers and not with people that you're close to? Okay, let's take a look at that more closely.
There might be something behind that.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
It could be social anxiety, but it also could be more.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, you don't know if you don't assess properly.
Right.
And sometimes that doesn't happen, that people don't get that sort of assessment. And so they end up with a misdiagnosis.
Yeah.
And, you know, these aren't just like wrong answers. A misdiagnosis isn't just that. Like we said at the very beginning, it can like drastically change a person's life, their self-perception, you know, the internal narrative they tell mm-hmm. themselves mm-hmm. about themselves and their role in the world.
Yeah. Supports they receive or don't receive based on a diagnosis.
Yeah. And some of the diagnoses that do get thrown out and that are like pretty common to be misdiagnosed are some of like the more stigmatized ones, like borderline, for instance. Mm-hmm. Okay, something behavioral. maybe not following along with neurotypical guidelines.
Yeah.
And we're just going to slap this diagnosis on. Seems mm-hmm. to be appropriate.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Is it really though?
Right. So let's talk about, I knew this was going to happen, that we are going to get on my, I will die on this hill about borderline personality disorder
let's
in women.
Hear it.
That I feel like it is modern day hysteria. That we are slapping this diagnosis on women when they don't conform to social expectations.
Oh, 100%. And then there's that, you know, not only the internal shame you get from having that diagnosis, but then again, the social stigma.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that that diagnosis is associated with, oh, you're a negative person to be around.
Right.
We don't want you in my life. Oh, yeah. This person's borderline.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to be around that.
Mm-hmm.
For half these people are probably uneducated and don't know what the nuances of this diagnosis even are.
Yeah.
But they know that like it.
Personality disorder sounds very severe and pervasive and something. When you talk about a disorder of someone's personality, that without further exploration sounds like, oh, that's real bad. It's a part of who you are. That can't be changed.
Yeah. And again, back to the idea of a misdiagnosis fundamentally altering like somebody's life.
Yeah.
If you're being told you have a personality disorder, which again, to the layperson sounds like this unchangeable
mm-hmm.
core part of who you are
mm-hmm.
that no one seems to like,
mm-hmm.
that has huge consequences.
Right, right.
How are you supposed to feel good about yourself?
Good question.
You're not.
You're not. You're not.
And obviously this isn't the only diagnosis that gets thrown out there. You see a lot of mood disorders, mm-hmm. whether that's depression or bipolar.
Yeah, bipolar disorder is a common one too, especially bipolar 2. Think about what the symptoms are of bipolar 2, mm-hmm. right? And consider symptoms of ADHD.
Yeah, the impulsivity, hyperactivity, maybe.
Yeah, hypomania can be confused for having a lot of energy and getting bursts of energy and hyperfocus.
Yeah. Which, sounds a lot like something else. it's funny.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How quick we are to associate it to like a bipolar thing of, okay, is this hypomania? And I think sometimes it's because these things are sensationalized.
Yeah.
It might be on somebody's mind a little more than an ADHD diagnosis.
Sure. Yeah. And on the other side of the hypomania, if you have bipolar 2, you go through cycles of hypomania and depression. But also, if you are someone who has ADHD, you might fluctuate between periods of having a lot of energy and feeling like you can get a lot done, and also falling into a shame spiral because you don't have the capacity to be able to do something, that you feel stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the task paralysis we talked about last episode.
Right.
Okay. I literally can't. I want to do things.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't. There's too many things. My brain's running on a million tabs. It's like when you have all those tabs open and then your screen starts buffering.
Yeah. So when you are feeling that way and like you are stuck, you are paralyzed, and you are feeling like you're shaming yourself because you can't do the thing, what does that also look like? Symptoms of depression.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So much overlap. And I'm not saying bipolar 2 is not an accurate diagnosis, I'm just highlighting just how similar these things are and how hard it is, especially getting into adulthood, to suss these things out. And lots of times people only figure out that bipolar 2 diagnosis might be wrong because they've been treated for it and it's not helping.
Yep. We've thrown all the things at this. Nothing seems to be improving.
All the typical things that we would think would help bipolar 2 aren't doing anything. So now what?
We must consider alternatives. Yeah. And so, you know, you just mentioned that like this happens a lot because of the fact that they look very similar. Like it makes sense to a certain point.
For sure.
And, you know, there are plenty of other reasons why it happens a lot, why these specific, you know, neurodivergent qualities, why they tend to be misdiagnosed as something else. And bias comes in.
Yeah, so much bias.
Yeah, our diagnostic system, it's growing. It still needs some improvement.
Yeah, there's lots of room for improvement still.
Yeah, historically, as we know, like most things, centered around white, cis, neurotypical males. That these presentations were based off of, right. What does it look like in a white guy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you don't look like the typical case of having any type of neurodivergence and often other mental health disorders as well, but focusing on neurodivergence today, if you don't look like that typical case, you could very easily be missed.
Yeah. Yeah, and to like add insult to injury in that sense of neurodivergent folks, I think specifically women,
mm-hmm.
but also like niche populations, like queer folks or people of color,
mm-hmm.
they are the ones who have to learn the masking behaviors. They're the ones who have to learn how to perform neurotypical behaviors in order to survive. And so they may not even see that they're masking.
Mm-hmm.
Clinicians might miss it.
Right.
Of, okay, you know, all of these neurodivergent diagnoses mm-hmm. are based off of what it looks like in a white male.
Mm-hmm.
What about all these other people who it shows up in different ways? And if you're not a white male mm-hmm. and you're not being treated adequately,
mm-hmm.
it makes sense as to why people would mask.
Right, right. Yeah, if we think of the stereotypical child that is male who is being diagnosed with autism or ADHD, there are very clear signs that people look for. And I didn't put this in my show notes, but I think it's also important to highlight even for kids that behaviors in white boys are treated differently than behaviors that are in black and brown children. Mm-hmm. That it is looked at as hyperactivity, typically with white children, but it's misbehavior when it's everyone else.
Yeah.
And it's punished rather than being diagnosed and supported.
Yeah.
How so fair is that? Folks go on, right, so fair, right? So then those folks go on to not receiving the support that they need and mm-hmm. just adds to the stigma and the difficulty for these folks to get a correct diagnosis, if any.
Yeah, and even on that front of maybe they never get a diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
but that is a social diagnosis in and of itself of, oh, you've been prescribed to be this like unruly, like delinquent.
Right. Right.
Versus
right.
again, like a cis white boy.
Yeah.
Oh, he's hyper. Okay. Let's bring him in. Let's mm-hmm. see if he's got ADHD. Let's medicate him. Let's do the things to try to
get him the support he needs
to get him to be able to thrive in this environment
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
while we're going to punish everyone else.
Yeah. There was recent research that I saw that compared rates of diagnoses between white and brown and black children, especially boys, that black and brown children were more likely to be diagnosed with ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, rather than ADHD.
Yeah, and that grinds my gears because it probably is ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, talk about the stigmatization and the ability for that ODD diagnosis to follow that child for the rest of their life.
Yeah, and it does.
It does.
Because, you know, oftentimes that's a diagnosis that if you receive it young, like your teachers are going to be aware of it.
Right.
The adults in your life are aware of it, of, oh, this is a problem child. And you get mm-hmm. pigeonholed into being the problem child.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that diagnosis overlaps a lot with complex trauma as well, just similar to borderline personality disorder.
Yeah.
So lots of times ODD turns into BPD diagnoses when children age up.
Yeah.
But rolling back to oppositional defiant disorder, this feels like something that lends an unfair view of a child.
Yeah.
To anyone who is going to come into contact with them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it essentially puts this child in a box of, okay, they're going to be defiant. of you. Mm-hmm. They're going to resist any sort of authority.
Right.
They're not going to be, what's the word? Like, they're not going to obey or mm-hmm. behave.
They're not going to conform.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think with most diagnoses, people typically, you know, therapists aren't trying to do harm right. when they, a well-intentioned therapist is not trying to do harm when they give diagnoses like these out.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that idea that mental health professionals, a lot of us are not trained to recognize neurodivergence
mm-hmm.
in all of its forms.
Yeah.
You know, for all of the things that we just said.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is important for us as mental health professionals to slow down and consider where these biases might be coming up for us. And I would like to teachers out there to make these considerations as well as you are making recommendations for children when you see these behaviors. Take a second and really reflect on what those biases might be for you, even if it's unconscious, if it's just your gut reaction to say, ooh, this feels like blah, blah, blah. Okay, let's slow down, back it up, and consider all my options in who I can refer this child to get correct supports and diagnoses rather yeah. than immediately punishing.
Yeah, and I think you made a great point right there as well of that, like, teachers often are at the forefront of this, and mm-hmm. they certainly don't get training to point this out.
Absolutely not. But they're the ones that are often witnessing, noticing, and making recommendations for these children because they see them so often and yeah. how they interact with others.
Yeah. So.
Yep. Yep. Good times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, lots of us aren't really trained to recognize neurodivergence in all its forms. It is very complex. So, again, they mean well, but the story doesn't really fit. So there's things like diagnostic overshadowing when autistic traits are misinterpreted or misattributed to other conditions, because like we said, so many things overlap.
Yep. Yep. Again, like potential trauma symptoms,
mm-hmm.
Potential like similarities in like anxiety or depression or mm-hmm. some of like the common ones that we see.
Yeah. And we talked about last episode that a lot of these things do co-occur. So it yeah. could be a neurodivergent yeah. diagnosis and have also developed anxiety or yeah. depression as a result.
Have we checked for that though is the thing.
Right.
Are we just slapping one of these labels on and calling it a day? Mm-hmm. Okay. This seems to fit. Let's yeah. keep it at that.
Yeah.
Or going the extra step to make sure we're not leaving a stone unturned.
Right. Right. Be more intentional.
Yeah. And, you know, again, back to the idea of the story not fitting. We had just talked about, like, the biases that occur on the gender front and the race front. And,
right.
You know, the rates of misdiagnosis among, like, white people versus people of color, specifically men, mm-hmm. or for gender, like, mm-hmm. women are typically diagnosed later in life mm-hmm. and are often misdiagnosed,
mm-hmm.
whereas, like, men typically receive their diagnosis pretty early if that's, you know,
right,
what their parents wanted or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Although there are still guys who get diagnosed later in life.
Absolutely. Especially with autism.
Yeah.
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 So in considering those things that we just talked about, the gender and racial bias, so we talked about what it looks like for Black and brown boys who are being labeled with ODD rather than sussing out if it might be a type of neurodivergence. I would like to consider what it might look like for a woman of color or a female child of color and how difficult it would be for them to receive a diagnosis even later in life.
Oh my gosh, like impossible when you think of like Black mm-hmm. women in general.
Absolutely.
Like they face like some of the biggest barriers to like adequate care.
Yeah.
Not only are they a person of color, but they're a woman.
Yeah.
And both of those things in this country mean you don't get top priority.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. We know that Black women are often labeled as having to be the strong Black women.
Yeah.
So think about how often, even without neurodivergence, they're having to mask.
Yeah. Yeah, just existing as a Black person, a Black mm-hmm. woman in this country.
Yeah. To maintain like you said, safety.
Yeah. If you literally have to put on a front, like masking just comes naturally.
Yeah. Yeah. So it'd be incredibly difficult to receive an accurate diagnosis if there is neurodivergence there for them.
Yeah.
And I would like, again, to challenge folks out there to consider those biases.
Yeah. That's why it's so important for clinicians to have trainings or resources and support in multiculturalism and intersectionality.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is so easy to miss these things.
It is.
If you're not aware that these are issues, if you're not aware that you're looking for them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That it's so important. I think, especially as, you know, as we know, a majority of our field are white women.
Mm-hmm.
Of we also have a responsibility to stay informed.
Yeah. And not always go to, well, this was my experience as a woman.
Yeah. I'm like, okay. Oh, but you're white.
Nope. Nope. Nope.
You're a white woman.
You need to consider
different.
That it is much, much different experience for you walking around in the safety of your whiteness that other people don't have the privilege yeah. to experience.
Yeah. You cannot rely on your lived experience as a way of.
I don't think we can rely on our lived experience in general. However, I have seen how it is easy to slip into that.
Yeah. Obviously, it can be well-intentioned. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, I get it. I'm also a woman.
I'm trying to understand you.
Yeah.
I get it. But
and
do you?
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah. Oh. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Just be okay with that.
Right.
I don't understand your experience. Yeah. Please, like, let's talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to like know to your understand.
Experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Again, with all therapy, but especially so in this context,
yeah.
to be open to explore, challenge biases, and challenge the systems.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The DSM is not the end-all be-all.
No, not by any means.
Mm-mm.
And, you know, I could get on my own personal soapbox about pathologizing in general and the DSM, yeah. but... Mm-hmm. That's for another time.
That is. That but, is. That could be a whole other just 3-part series just
oh, it absolutely that. Could.
Yeah.
15-part
yeah.
series.
Yeah. So back to reasons why it's difficult to receive some of these diagnoses. Inaccessible services.
Yeah.
You know how expensive it is to get a psychological evaluation?
So expensive.
Just thousands of dollars. Lots of insurance companies are more apt to pay for it now. However, if you are underinsured or uninsured, these services are completely inaccessible to you.
Yeah. So there's no way you're going to get that diagnosis.
No.
No way somebody's going to meticulously comb through and assess.
Right. Right. It's hard to find people who are thoroughly trained to be able yeah, to do that.
That's true. It does take extra. It takes additional training to be able to provide right. psychological evaluations.
Yeah. We talked about how much overlap there is. It takes a very skilled, trained professional to be able to suss out those differences and make an accurate diagnosis.
Yeah. And so, you know, kind of that idea that we even putting in that earlier of like some people just never get diagnosed and mm-hmm. that's part of the reason
mm-hmm.
that just is not in the wheelhouse of possibility.
Yep. Yep.
So they're going to go with what society tells them that might be.
Right. Right. The easier path.
Yeah.
So misdiagnosis can be really harmful. And I'd like to explore and talk about why that might be.
Yeah. So obviously, if you are misdiagnosed, it means you may not be receiving adequate services.
Mm-hmm.
You may not be getting adequate support.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the wrong meds, maybe the wrong kind of treatment altogether.
Right.
So like that idea of medication, people mm-hmm. might get prescribed medications that don't help or make it worse.
Right.
Like, you know, I've had a client with autism before who was misdiagnosed with depression and they were put on all these meds and really adverse side effects.
Yeah.
Like this isn't what's wrong with my brain.
Right.
And we're treating the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but it unfortunately takes trials to fail of medication in therapy to get to a point of, okay, let's go back to the drawing board and why none of these things are working. And that's not something that happens in a couple of weeks or months.
This is like years
of perhaps receiving the wrong medication, receiving the wrong type of therapy, that you sought out therapy because this is the diagnosis you received.
Yeah.
But that's also not helping or not helping fully.
Yeah. Yeah. And going back to even the deeper, more emotional part of it is we've talked about how it can like fundamentally change a person of, especially I think in the context of how they see themselves, their own internal narrative about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If you receive a diagnosis that isn't appropriate and you don't seem to be responding to any sort of treatment,
mm-hmm.
I think a shame spiral is pretty easy to get into.
So easy.
Why isn't this working for me? Why can't I just get better? Am I just being difficult?
Yeah. Should I just pull myself up by my bootstraps and suck it up and just do what they say?
Yeah. And it's like, no, because they're treating the wrong thing.
Yeah.
It's not that you're broken. It's that the system wasn't built to understand you. Mm-hmm. That people don't put neurodivergence first. They don't look for it. Mm-mm. So they're not treating it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's typically not the first to go to.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hope we are moving towards a point where we place neurodivergence aside, mental health diagnoses, to consider them all together. I think we might be a ways from that. But I am hopeful as we start to understand this more that we can move towards that.
Yeah, that like co-occurrence happens mm-hmm. pretty often. And it, as you were saying that, it made me think about like the addictions realm.
Yeah.
The baseline there's typically mm-hmm. there's a co-occurrence mm-hmm. between some sort of substance use and a mental health condition.
Right.
Obviously the clinician is going to suss out, you know, is it primary? Is it secondary? You know, is this causing it
mm-hmm.
because of the addiction? Is it secondary? Whatever. Mm-hmm. But that's something that they just naturally look for.
Yeah.
Of, okay, if you have a substance use problem, you probably are also struggling with something else. Let's assess for that.
Right. Right.
Of maybe that could be the hopeful trend with neurodivergence. Of,
right.
Okay. If you're struggling with something, is there also potentially neurodivergence at play?
Yeah. Could the impulsivity of ADHD be a reason why it might be difficult for you to heal from a substance abuse disorder?
Yeah.
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 Yep. But, so many strings. There's a great point about addiction and truly considering all avenues.
Yeah.
And again, that's another diagnosis that is so deeply shamed because we want to believe that people can have mind over matter and just choose to stop.
Yeah.
It's not how this works.
Nope.
It's not how any of this works.
Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So but, difficult to suss it out.
Yeah, absolutely. But as you and I both know, mm-hmm. in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. Having a better understanding.
Yeah. Autism diagnosis rates have been increasing over mm-hmm. time. And there are several reasons for that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, there's some popular opinions at the moment that it is being overdiagnosed and it is a new thing that didn't exist in the past.
Like, that is such a lie.
It is. It is.
It's that one that we weren't as aware of it.
Yeah.
So, like, we failed to recognize signs of it. We have better access to like how to adequately evaluate these things,
mm-hmm.
not just in white guys,
right,
but in people of color, people who are low income, female presenting people,
mm-hmm.
and
not simply diagnosing someone with autism who is and has really difficult time functioning.
Yeah.
That it doesn't have to just be, it was for a long time, just folks who were nonverbal or had a difficulty functioning independently. Those were the folks who were like, oh yeah, easy.
Yep.
This person has autism.
Yeah.
But that's not what it looks like for everybody. And we're starting to understand the intricacies of that more.
Yeah.
And that it truly is on a spectrum where somebody could appear to be very high functioning, but they're struggling internally.
Yep. Exactly. Like you said, like we've I think, made good strides at expanding the diagnostic criteria for neurodivergence, I think, especially in the realm of like autism, that it is a spectrum that, you know, you have like the higher functioning realm and you have the lower functioning realm, but you have everywhere in between. And so there isn't one typical presentation of what autism looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. And if we think about our, I come from a family of neurodivergents who no one has been diagnosed, but I can think about my grandmother and how everybody just thought she was quirky and was sensitive to different stimuli. And her children also have some of these things. So you can, I can so clearly see now as an adult understanding these things, what was happening here. But no one ever received a diagnosis because we saw these kids or even adults and you're like, oh, they're just quirky. Oh, they just have really specialized interests.
Yep. And it's like, Yeah.
So I think just because the diagnosis wasn't there doesn't mean it didn't exist.
Exactly. Yeah. Like you were saying, of you even being able to look back at your grandmother, of, oh, she's just a quirky person. And if you have kids and they share similar traits, you're going to say, oh, the quirkiness was just because their mom was quirky.
Right.
It's like, oh, they just passed it. I'm like, neurodivergence is also genetic.
But let's talk about the clear line of it being genetic here.
Yeah. Strong genetic component.
That also is a reason why a lot of adults are being diagnosed in adulthood, that because we have a much better understanding of diagnostic criteria and what it looks like more broadly, that more children are becoming diagnosed or getting diagnosed so they get correct services. And then those practitioners who are making these diagnoses have conversations with parents about, this has a very high genetic component. Let's talk about exploring that and coming to, maybe that is me.
Yeah.
And seeking out diagnoses for themselves.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
All of the greater understanding. So that is part of why these diagnosis rates are increasing.
Yeah. Right?
And there's better access to evaluation now.
Mm-hmm.
Still not great, but it has come a long way from
better.
Even 5-10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of across specialties. And also, I know you and I have mixed feelings about telehealth in general, but again, one of the uses for it.
Yeah.
It can make it more accessible.
Yep. Absolutely. And in the realm of accessibility, it is still really uneven. BIPOC, low income, and female presenting people are still undiagnosed.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. So lots of delayed diagnoses are kind of catching up. And many people, especially women, adults, and queer folks, were missed as children. And a lot of them are receiving late diagnosis and are now being counted in that diagnostic number overall. So it looks like, oh, damn, a lot of people are being diagnosed with this all of a sudden. It seems like a trend.
Yeah, it's like, no, there's just awareness for it now.
Yeah.
And that, like, it's, like, you can get diagnosed as an adult, and that's totally normal.
Yeah, yeah. So thinking about misdiagnosis potentially the other way, that perhaps someone is diagnosed as a child and maybe that doesn't quite fit. So yes, misdiagnosis can and does happen, but true overdiagnosis is really rare.
Yeah, it's not likely to happen with like something like autism, for instance. People are typically misdiagnosed with something else instead of autism. Again, whether it's BPD, OCD, social anxiety. Some people might receive like even a provisional label of like, okay, not totally sure what this is yet. But that's not the same thing as like an overdiagnosis of, okay, maybe meets criteria for this, maybe further evaluation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So autism and ADHD are not a trend or identity that people claim lightly by any means. It's a lifelong neurodevelopmental difference that comes both with strengths and challenges.
Yep. Yeah. And obviously, diagnostic standards still require significant social and or sensory impact on functioning, not just having a few traits. So there's like a thoroughness with these sort of diagnoses.
Yeah.
So it's unlikely to be overdiagnosed.
Very. Yeah. So bottom line here, the rising autism rates come from better recognition and not a false epidemic.
Yep.
So rather than worrying about overdiagnosis, we should really focus on ensuring accurate, affirming evaluations, addressing those racial, gender, and economic disparities and biases in diagnosis.
Yeah.
And working to provide supports that match people's real needs, whether they're diagnosed or not. They don't need a diagnosis to receive support.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great point that a lot of people think that they need one in order to get help, in order to get support. And it can make it helpful. In some cases,
that might be true, that like children in school often can't receive supports in schools unless they are labeled with a diagnosis. However, when I'm thinking about something like therapy, you don't need to have a neurodivergent or a mental health diagnosis to come in and get support.
Yeah.
You can still help.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for the people who are diagnosed, misdiagnosed, a lot of times, like, the path towards clarity of maybe getting an accurate diagnosis is starting with a second opinion. Yeah. Or even self-diagnosis, which I know is a controversial thing lately, I think, especially with like TikTok and all the social media self-diagnosing.
Yeah. Yeah. We touched on that a little bit in the last episode, talking about self-diagnosis and how a lot of clinicians write it off. But I think there's a lot of value to slowing down and exploring that.
Yeah.
And helping people make sense of things.
Because people aren't making this up.
No, people aren't taking these things lightly. Like, if somebody is coming to a point where they're starting to believe that they have some neurodevelopmental disorder, that they might have autism, it's not just because, oh, I saw this one TikTok video and I don't know, it seemed kind of like me.
Like, no, these are, it like hits home. It is like very personal. You're like, okay, all of these really resonate with me. Something about this obviously fits.
Right.
And so your role as a therapist then is to help make sense of the years of confusion they've had and help them solidify language and terminology that like fits their experience. And so oftentimes through that, whether it's the self-diagnosing, whether it's reaching out for a second opinion, when somebody finally gets that accurate diagnosis, they're like, okay, it is actually ADHD. It is autism. Maybe a combination of both.
Yeah.
This is how my brain actually works. There's grief in that, but there's also oftentimes a huge sense of relief.
Right. Right.
Finally, something that it all feels makes like sense. Me.
How many times do we hear, oh my God, my whole life makes sense?
Yes.
I wasn't lazy.
No.
I wasn't choosing not to do a thing. I wasn't being defiant.
Yeah. Literally differences in your brain. Your brain is
Making up how uncomfortable those clothes made me.
Yeah.
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 Pulling out some of that shame that has been in there.
Absolutely.
And blame of self for potentially many, many, many years.
Yeah. Especially for people who are diagnosed late. They've been going through life, you know, not having that understanding of thinking that they're a problem or they're too much, or
they feel different.
They feel different, othered. And when you don't have that diagnosis or you're misdiagnosed, like there's a potential for like self-othering. Okay, I'm just different. I don't know how to fit in. I can't do these things. I can't be a part of this.
Yeah. But when these diagnoses come about suddenly, things that didn't make sense do. Yeah. And then there's community. There's accommodation. There's self-compassion.
Yeah, there's like a bunch of doors you didn't know existed. And suddenly they're all open for you.
Yeah, I was trying to go through all of these windows and put in extra effort and climb through and fit in and make myself normal.
Like, yeah, putting a square in a circle. Doesn't work.
Yep. So getting the correct diagnosis isn't about putting someone in a box. It is about opening that door.
Yeah. Yep. And again, often very liberating in a sense, like a lot of relief.
Yeah. Wow. Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to go back to talking about late life diagnoses, because we know a lot of these happen in childhood. Mm-hmm. So what about adults being diagnosed? What is typically happening there?
Yeah. So I think going back to like the story you told about your grandmother,
mm-hmm.
generational differences, lack of understanding, like that terminology, the information that we have now, maybe was not accessible.
Right.
In her generation, mm-hmm. her era, just wasn't a thing.
I mean, for the longest time, women. People believed that ADHD and autism didn't happen in girls.
Yeah. It was just,
it was just for little boys.
Oh, like that.
That alone.
It is something that impacts the brain.
Right. So why
Pretty
would
sure
it only,
everyone has a brain.
Right. So why would it only impact cis males? Exactly.
Yep. So on top of like the gender disparities, there are like cultural things in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like we said, they're becoming much more common and they reveal a powerful and really often painful truth that many autistic people, especially adults, and not just with autism, but with ADHD and all different types of neurodivergent brains, that they were missed entirely by the systems that were supposed to see them.
Yeah.
So let's kind of break down what's going on when an adult is diagnosed with neurodivergence, sometimes in their 30s, 40s, 50s, or beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so obviously there are outdated stereotypes mm-hmm. that go along with that.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to like the young white cis boys who like showed pretty clear signs of neurodivergence, whether that was like developmental delays, the hyperactivity, the whatever it is.
The inattention.
Yep. We had like these kind of like stereotypical, this is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In reality, there's a lot more nuance to it than just that.
For sure.
So people who didn't like quote unquote look autistic, uh-huh. according to like these outdated models, outdated stereotypes, were missed. Like you said, like women, for instance, it just wasn't considered that mm-hmm. they could even have this.
Yeah.
But on top of that, all the other populations we've mentioned who tend to not be in the spotlight,
mm-hmm.
queer folks,
mm-hmm.
people of color,
mm-hmm.
People with high intelligence. And I think this is
even average intelligence a lot, but specifically, I think that's a great point. Folks with high intelligence were often written off and missed completely because you're functioning really well.
Yeah.
You can't have any type of neurodevelopmental disorder here.
Yeah.
You're doing great. You're functioning well in
colors.
You're functioning well in a capitalist society. So you're good.
Yep.
You're normal.
Like,
whatever that means.
Yeah.
So back to masking and camouflaging that lots of folks with neurodivergence, especially women and gender diverse folks,
mm-hmm.
learn to mask, to mimic social behaviors, to suppress stimming, over preparing for interactions.
Yeah.
Rehearsing phone calls.
Yep.
Rehearsing in your mind arguments or conversations you might want to have with someone.
Yep. At length. Happening all the time.
At length. And the difficulty folks with different types of neurodivergence have picking up the phone sometimes because there's
so
much.
It's a big deal. It's not just picking up the phone, dialing a number, and calling somebody.
Right.
Of, okay, what tone am I going to use?
Right.
How am I going to communicate, like, what I actually want to communicate effectively?
Right. What happens if they ask me a follow-up question?
They go off script.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of that over-preparing.
Yeah. And so while that over-preparing helps them pass in neurotypical spaces, like we talked about a little bit last time, it comes at a steep mental health cost.
Yeah. Yeah. So then instead of being recognized as some type of neurodivergent, many late diagnosed adults come in full circle here. We're labeled with anxiety, depression, borderline personality disorder, OCD, or just simply written off as being too sensitive, being difficult, being quirky.
Ugh, yeah.
And these labels didn't fully explain their experience and often didn't help.
Oh, the only thing it did was like solidify the shame that they felt.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm not quote unquote normal.
Right.
Something about me is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. So lots of adults pursue a diagnosis for lots of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about when a child is diagnosed and they begin to see patterns in themselves.
Yep.
Last week we talked about burnout.
Yeah.
So having that extreme level of burnout or major life stress and how things suddenly become so overwhelming and in such a state of disarray that you try to understand why.
Yep. Yep. And then also the exposure to neurodivergence on social media, like we talked about,
mm-hmm.
or even in other types of media, like books, yeah. for instance,
mm-hmm.
like seeing the neurodivergent character who maybe has a lot of traits,
right.
like you do, and you're like,
huh.
something seems oddly similar.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah, or
TV, I don't know, did you watch The Pit?
I started it.
Oh.
It's intense.
It is intense, but there's multiple characters who are neurodivergent, and they make just normal comments about one of the doctors says, yeah, most of us in the ER have ADHD because any other job would be boring.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
The like novelty.
What we talked about last time of not only the novelty, but like they can handle the pressure.
Right.
Like they do well in chaos.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. But there are several neurodivergent characters in that show that I love so much because it is portrayed in a realistic way.
Yeah.
That
and it's so powerful when you see parts of yourself on TV.
Yeah.
In books. On social media.
Representation matters.
So important. And anyone who says that representation in media doesn't matter is a liar.
Right. Or they just don't understand because they have always been represented in general popular media.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of like seeing it on a TV screen.
Yeah.
Someone close to you might also point it out.
Yeah.
That's often a reason why people may get curious and pursue a diagnosis later.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Or a family member, or even your therapist.
Yeah.
I point out.
Maybe a family member received a diagnosis and say, hey, this kind of actually looks like it might be you too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, anecdotally, from my experience, like, one of my siblings got diagnosed with ADHD. And I was like, okay. I think I could see it.
Okay.
And then you start seeing the patterns in your family in general.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I see it.
Yeah.
I see it.
Yep. Well, I saw it for me is. Well, that I saw patterns of autism in my family, and my son was diagnosed with ADHD, and the signs pointed out by his play therapist at the time seemed very obvious,
mm-hmm.
but it even took, he was around 7
mm-hmm.
when he was diagnosed, and I wasn't until 3 years ago.
Yeah.
So 3 years, that would have been 6-ish years in between then that it took for me to make the connection. And it wasn't even me.
Yeah.
It was a psychiatrist that I made a suggestion to that, hey, my depression medication is not working the way that I feel like it could be, the way that I see it work well for other people, especially being a therapist. And he was very kind about bringing up the possibility. I was like, okay. Let's talk about what symptoms make you feel like it mm-hmm. might be something else.
Yeah.
And he asked if there was anybody neurodivergent in my family. And I said, yes. And said that my son was diagnosed and asked what symptoms that we noticed in my son.
I'm guessing they asked.
Oddly enough,
those
same symptoms were the things that I just said that made me think I had a mental health diagnosis that were what we noticed in my son with ADHD.
Yep.
And he straight challenged and said, so why is it ADHD for him and something else for you? And I was like, hot damn, I don't know.
You're like, that's a good point.
That is a great question, sir.
Yeah, I think that goes to show that even us in the field, like, we're not,
yeah.
like, we're not all knowing. We're not going to immediately see that.
No, and how socially programmed are we?
Yeah, that like
women, there's something wrong mentally with you, not neurodevelopmentally.
Yeah, that like we immediately default to, okay, like
I am mentally ill.
Yeah, I'm mentally ill. I'm like, hey, maybe your brain just works differently.
Yeah. And both and. Sure, I was diagnosed with ADHD, but depression's still there. Probably from those years of shame.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. But he was incredible. And I hope that more psychiatrists and psychiatric providers start being more open to those possibilities, too, of sussing those things out and asking those questions that are actually really simple to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anybody in your family who is neurodivergent? Could be no. Okay, cool. Maybe that may alleviate the possibility a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But ask.
Yeah. Because who knows where it'll lead you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But.
So when adults receive these diagnoses as adults, I know it was for me, that it was both devastating and liberating because devastating because of all those years of shaming and blaming myself and suffering in silence and masking, but also liberating in, oh damn, I understand why these things are the way they are and why I enact all these hacks to get things done in my life.
Yes.
And okay, now I'm open to more of those things to help me feel like I
absolutely
can do the things I need to do.
Yeah. And that pivot from shame to self-compassion is sometimes, it is such like a noticeable switch. And in that moment, like when they really acknowledge it, oh, like it's my brain.
Yeah.
Nothing's wrong with me.
Yeah.
Like I'm wired differently.
It is actually out of my control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Insane. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can literally see it on a person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The absolute relief.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can start reframing past experiences, like we said.
Mm-hmm.
Get different, more adequate support, finding community. Having that self-compassion also leads to having increased sense of self-esteem.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, once you have that diagnosis, like especially if you're somebody who's diagnosed later in life, there's, like you said, like you can start finding community based on that. Of like, okay, there are probably also people who are diagnosed later in life who are also just learning how to navigate this.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be something that you're alone in. It opens the door for you to like learn about your neurodivergence on your own terms.
Yeah.
Beyond like the clinical checklists of, okay, like you meet the criteria for these things. That like we were talking about earlier, that even that idea of like self-diagnosis, a lot of it comes from like self-researching.
Right.
Of even if you have the diagnosis already, you can continue to research and learn more about like what fits you.
Right.
Because neurodivergence is such a spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The way it presents in you is probably pretty unique.
Yeah.
Yeah. You share overlap, but the exact presentation, unlikely to find it in another person. And I think that's
because we're still all unique individuals.
Yeah. 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 So, and then on that front, again, finding a therapist who is neurodivergent affirming, who understands that, like what we just said, that is such a unique thing, who goes beyond the medical model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Again, I think I've said this 10 times, but I'll say it again. The fact that so many adults are being diagnosed now does not mean that neurodivergence is new or trendy. It means we're looking in the right places.
Yeah. And while a late diagnosis can't undo the past, it has such the power to reshape your future, to be able to live with more authenticity, with more clarity, better access to care, and more support.
Yeah. Yeah. So if this episode stirred something in you, if you're thinking back to moments where you felt misunderstood, mislabeled, or invisible, want you to hear this. You're not broken. You're not too much. You are not making it up. You are a whole, complex, beautifully wired person deserving of care that sees you clearly.
Yeah, beautifully said. Well, like usual, thanks for joining us on the podcast today. If this episode meant something to you, please consider sharing it, leaving a review, or even starting a conversation with someone you trust. And as always, stay curious, stay compassionate, and stay radically yourself.
Until next time.
See ya.